This week in Chicago history now with Anna DeVlanta, sponsored by visituihealth.care. And Anna, I didn't know Soldier Field wasn't always Soldier Field.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting history. Good morning, Bob. You know, this week, 1925, so it's a 100-year anniversary, Soldier Field officially received its name, and it was a moving ceremony back then, and a really moving reason, of course, that behind it that caused the renaming. So it was Armistice Day when they decided to hold this tremendous ceremony across the city. 100,000 people gathered, and they decided they wanted to dedicate the stadium to our veterans and those who had paid the ultimate sacrifice for our country. They wanted the stadium to be a living memorial for American veterans. Back then, it was known as Grant Park Stadium, built as part of Daniel Burnham's plan to have a South Lakefront Park and a civic gathering place available for public use. But over the decades, it was hosting all kinds of things. It wasn't a sports facility back then. It was charity events. There were major speakers from around the world who came there. They'd honor military. They'd have massive city events, and first responders were honored, concerts, all kinds of things. It didn't become a mostly sports facility until the Bears made it their home in the 1971 season when they moved from Wrigley. But the Gold Star Mothers were the ones who were really, really instrumental in just making this change. They had petitioned passionately to change the name from Grant Park Stadium, saying that we should honor our veterans and those who have paid the price. So the ceremony was this huge event, 21-gun salute. They had planes flying overhead. Like I said, 100,000 people. They had a moment of silence. And there was a message from the mayor at the time, Mayor Devers, who said, "This is not going to be a tomb of heroes. It will be a place, a field for free men to gather in their name," and just signifying the future of Soldier Field. So there you go. The Stadium of the People was born at that moment.
I wonder what they're going to name the Arlington Heights Stadium if they ever build it. Maybe they should
Maybe
they should call it Grant Park Stadium. Tip of the cap to Soldier Field. Happy birthday tomorrow to one of the nicest guys in show business for sure, Joe Mantegna.
You must have interviewed him over the years, Bob, many times, or met him.
Yeah, he's a fellow hot dog lover, too.
Yeah, he's all Chicago, isn't he?
Yep.
78 years young tomorrow, Joe Mantegna. He is Chicago's success story through and through. Grew up in the Italian neighborhood on the west side, moved to Cicero, went to DePaul's drama school, organic theater. He starred in Bleacher Bums, a lot of people will remember. That was the tribute to Cubs fans. And then he teamed up with famed local playwright David Mamet, who later asked him to star in Glengarry Glen Ross. And that is when his Hollywood career took off. He was already an accomplished actor. He won a Tony Award for Glengarry Glen Ross. And then a lot of Hollywood opportunities came calling. So a lot of people will know and love Joe Mantegna from all the different roles he's played over the years. But Bears fans in particular will remember him in Bill Swirsky's Sports Fans, a.k.a. the Bears superfans. He was in the first one, Bob, and we pulled a clip from that SNL sketch.
That's how it all started.
So it's hard to believe it's that long ago, but it's so funny. You're right, Bob. It certainly had an impact over the years. It has stuck, for sure.
Yeah, and for Joe, Criminal Minds goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
I can't believe that this happened, but this week in 1953, an airline did something that, well, let's just say you'll never hear about this again.
No, this had its day, and I can't see it ever coming back. But, Bob, United Airlines, Chicago-based, of course, launched this very popular new service at the time in 1953. So go back in time, 1953. It was an exclusive special executive flights for men only, no women and children allowed. And it was like a club or a country club in the sky. It was for busy Chicago professionals. They could smoke cigars on the plane. They could puff away on their pipes. They could drink whiskey and play cards and socialize. And they'd be served a full steak dinner while they were doing it with open bar. And so it was just this hit, you know. There was just, you know, you think about Mad Men in that time, and this was sort of an extension of that. There are these ads that are so cool. If you go and just Google them, there's all the guys hanging around playing poker or smoking around, and it's just hard to think about the time when this was the way it was. They weren't even wearing seatbelts, Bob. They're just sitting there at a card table on the plane, smoking away with their slippers on. They got slippers as part of the deal. So very different point in time, but daily Chicago to New York City flights, very expensive, but the male executives were flocking to them until As you might imagine, they kind of fell out of favor for a lot of different reasons. Certainly, talk about flying the friendly skies, Bob. That was one way to do it in the 1950s.
Yeah, maybe they were talking about the Bears on those flights,
the
too.
The Bears. Yeah. No, it might have come up.
Chicago can claim the switchboard was invented here, Anna.
Yeah, multiple lines on a switchboard invented right here. In fact, Chicago made a number of innovations and inventions created here in the city that really changed communications. That, of course, was Lily Tomlin and her nod to the famous switchboard operators at the time. See, back in the day, kids, you needed actually a human to connect you when you called in to your actual line that you wanted to, when you wanted to talk to someone, right? So that's how it went. And it's interesting because while Alexander Graham Bell received the first patent for the telephone, Chicago inventors played this huge role in a lot of the scaling of telephone networks. Less than 2 years after Bell's patent, the Chicago Telephone Exchange was formed, 1878. By 1880, there were 3,000 telephones in the Chicago area. That tripled in the next decade. And Chicago was trying to figure out how to connect all these people's phone lines. Like, how do you get, you know, you got too many people. You know, now you got too many lines. And so John Joseph O'Connell, a Bell employee and protege of Alexander Graham Bell himself, was here in Chicago, and he invented these switchers that could run multiple conversations on the same wire. And then the Hello Girls were born. They were known as the Hello Girls because they'd answer with a polite hello, and they'd ask you which number you'd like to be connected to. Number, please. Initially, actually, Bob, it was just the name of the person and the business because there weren't that many, but it grew into numbers. And that was all located at 125 South LaSalle, the first telephone exchange in the Chicago area. Lots of just interesting history there because it grew, and a lot of inventions grew out of necessity. Necessity is the mother of invention, and a number of different telephone inventions were made here, including the way to use coins to operate a telephone, the beginning of the payphone. Also, Chicago.
The multi-line switchboard developed this week in 1893, and it makes me long for the days when you could dial 411 information and speak to somebody.
A human, right?
Yeah,
I totally missed that too.
We've been giving away tickets here to the opera, and you have some interesting history about the Opera House and how it all started.
Yeah, 1929, Bob. 6 days after the stock market crash, the Civic Opera of Chicago opened its doors as a theater and an opera stage. And this idea was really bold. It was to create an opera company supported by the people of Chicago on the premise that artistic venues should be public institutions, not elite institutions. And they built the Opera House in commercial space. And so if you ever wonder why there's commercial space attached to it, it was so the rents could support the art. And all that sounded really well and good and might have worked, except the Great Depression pretty much wiped it out. So it remained on life support for many years. 25 years later, also this week, roughly in early November 1954, a new era of philanthropists stepped in to build the Lyric Opera of Chicago. And it was designed to be one of the most beautiful opera houses in the world, world-renowned. They wanted it to be. So they somehow convinced opera megastar Maria Callas, the world's most famous opera singer at the time, to make her American debut at the Lyric Opera in Chicago, which was huge, huge if you think about it. She was an American, born in New York, but had become a star in Europe. And so she came to perform at the Lyric in Chicago, and it immediately put the Opera House on the map. One of the things I love, Bob, is when you walk around the Loop and you see the clever sayings they use to market the performances on the marquees.
Oh, yeah, it's cool.
They had parking in the back, passion in the front. And it's just so fun how they promote the arts on those little marquees. Very clever.
It's a great Chicago treasure. And finally, we all remember either setting up a Kool-Aid stand or buying some Kool-Aid from kids. And it all started in Chicago this week in 1931.
Bob, do you remember the Kool-Aid man? The guy, the big picture of Kool-Aid?
yeah, with the smiling face on the picture. Yeah.
Right. He'd smash through a brick wall, anything. If you were thirsty, that guy just showed up. And so it's just interesting how that iconic figure became the face of it. But the Kool-Aid itself started in Nebraska, but really quickly moved to Chicago because it was this regional thing. And they wanted the inventor wanted it to become this national brand, Edwin Perkins. And he saw that all these big food brands and beverage companies were just taking off out of Chicago at that time. And so he moved all his operations here. And then he opened up a big giant manufacturing plants on the city's southwest side. He headquartered it here. He advertised heavily, and he came up with that giant pitcher of Kool-Aid that became the household thing that everyone remembers if you were around in the 70s or 80s, and I think into the early 90s. But we pulled a retro ad that may bring back memories for some of your listeners, Bob.
Of course, you had two camps in the neighborhood. You had the Kool-Aid lovers and then people who liked Lick-A-Made. Remember that? You put it on your hand and lick it off?
Yeah, loved that. That had to be so good for you too, Bob.
Oh, right? Yeah. Sure.
Imagine how the kids acted after you gave them a bunch of Lick-A-Made. They were running around the neighborhood.
Yeah, but the Kool-Aid Party Patrol was big in the Midwest in the summer, wasn't it?
See if your listeners remember this, because it was your childhood wish if you're in the 70s and into the early 80s, where the Kool-Aid guy was paying visits to people's parties, their backyards, their neighborhood, you know, block parties and things like that, even went to the Taste of Chicago. And if you took your proof of purchases out and you sent it into the company with some kind of form, a contest form, there was a chance that Kool-Aid would show up at your event or your house. And so they would run these ads where the big Kool-Aid pitcher was showing up, breaking through the door, and there he was, ready to sugar you up.
And somehow drink the Kool-Aid has taken on a whole new meaning, hasn't it?
We're talking about that. That's true.
We'll talk again next Wednesday. Anna DeVlantis, This Week in Chicago History. Thank you, Anna.
Of course.